You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. The program you are about to hear is a part of the Virginia Festival of the Book, held in Charlottesville, Virginia from March 21st through 25th, 2012. It was originally recorded in the City of Charlottesville Council Chambers by Charlottesville TV 10.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Are you able to hear me? Because I don't need, this is for recording purposes only that we have this mic. Thank you all for coming out this afternoon on this beautiful day. My name is Josh Wheeler. I'm the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. If you're not familiar with the center, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution that has as its sole mission the protection of the First Amendment rights of freedom of speech and freedom of press. About half of what we do is appellate litigation, but the other half of what we do is, for lack of a better term, outreach. Programs designed to hopefully foster greater appreciation for the incredible, important role that free speech plays in a democratic society. We're especially proud of the fact that the Thomas Jefferson Center has sponsored or participated in an event at every one of the Virginia Festival of the Books since its inception. And what better vehicle to celebrate the right of free speech than this terrific, terrific book festival. I'm going to turn the mic over to our moderator in just a minute. I've made sure we organized this event, but then I was so excited about this particular event, I wanted to make sure I got to enjoy it with the rest of you, so I'm not doing anything after this. But I'm going to turn the microphone over to our moderator, Sarah McConnell. I'm going to introduce in just a second, but I want to let you know, if you're interested in purchasing a copy of Tongue-Tied America, the book that we're here to discuss today, it will be available for sale afterwards, after the discussion, and I think you could prevail upon the authors to sign a copy if you would like and inscribe it. It makes a great Mother's Day gift. Sarah McConnell is somebody, if you don't know her by face, you probably know her by voice. She is the producer and host of the radio program With Good Reason, a terrific show which you may hear on any of the public radio stations throughout Virginia, and in fact a number of public radio stations across the country. It's a terrific program in which they get some of the greatest minds from Virginia's colleges and universities to talk on a whole wide variety of topics, ranging from the arts to politics to culture. I couldn't think of anybody better to interview the authors of Tongue-Tied America. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Sarah McConnell.
Thank you, Josh, and thanks to the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression for sponsoring this event. This is the event put on by the Virginia Festival of the Book, which is hosted by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. I'd like to also thank the City of Charlottesville and Charlottesville TV 10, in particular the man behind the scenes, Joe Rice, who puts on all of these events that take place here in City Council Chambers and are then cycled for a good period of time for a wide audience to view. I know I've loved the shows, been mesmerized by them, and I'm glad in particular that this one has the opportunity to be cycled through for a number of months to come. I had the pleasure of interviewing Molly and Bob for With Good Reason program that was received to great effect by our audience. People wanted copies and passed along copies of their interview to their colleagues. Before I get into my introductions of them, let me remind you that cell phones should be quieted. And if you notice you have a yellow sheet, this is a survey to see how you enjoyed this event today. It has a front and a back, and if you'd fill that out at the end of the show and pass it to our volunteers, that would be wonderful. Robert Nelson Saylor is a graduate of Stanford and Harvard Law School. He is a partner at Covington & Burling and one of the nation's most respected and effective litigators. The National Law Journal has included him in the list of top 100 most influential lawyers. Bob joined the University of Virginia Law School faculty in 2003. He lectures regularly at universities and law firms across the country, and even recently conducted via video hookup a broadcast into Baghdad that was for Iraqi and American lawyers and judges. Molly Bishop Shadle graduated magna cum laude from Harvard and earned her law degree from Columbia. She clerked for Judge Eugene Nickerson of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York and was a litigator with Bob's firm, Covington & Burling. In 2002, Molly represented the United States on terrorism matters before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. She joined the UVA Law Faculty in 2005. As if this weren't enough, Molly has also studied theater at Northwestern University and directed plays professionally in New York. Like Bob, she is a frequent lecturer for law firms and bar associations across America. In fact, Bob and Molly have been in such demand together for their presentations. They've co-authored this book, Tongue-Tied America, Reviving the Art of Verbal Persuasion. Molly and Bob will give us a presentation and then take questions at the conclusion, and afterward they'll be available to sign books and speak with you individually. Bob.
Thank you, Josh and Sarah. The best line about our line of business didn't come from us at all. It came from Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld says that at a funeral, most of the audience would rather be lying in the coffin than standing up at the podium delivering the eulogy. Surely it doesn't apply to anybody here, but maybe you know somebody who feels that way. There are powerful forces at work that stand between all of us and excellence as a public speaker. And that's what I want to talk about. Barrier one, we don't teach it. And that's just nuts. We have taken polls in our classes over the years, and I've talked to other professors about the very same thing, and I'm too close to the microphone because I get too excited. Great students with great academic backgrounds, we ask them to hold up their hands on day one. How many have had any experience speaking or any training at all? Were it under 5%? That is just crazy. It is this forgotten stepchild of American education, and one really ponders why in the world is that in every human endeavor once we leave the hallowed halls of written exams and written papers in everyone, home life, the neighborhood, making speeches to the PTA, in your jobs. We are being judged, graded, respected if we are good speakers all the time when we're talking, right? And the exact opposite when we're awkward, scared, inarticulate, obnoxious, any of those. It's a big deal to be at least a comfortable speaker, and we don't teach it. Less than 5%. Have been trained. Barrier two, fear. The number one fear, phobia of all, trumping virtually all other phobias combined, is glossophobia, fear of public speaking. It afflicts 80% of even educated adults, half of whom have serious physical manifestations before they speak. Heart palpitations, sweating, stomach problems. The upshot is what it has to be. The upshot is that we run away from it, right? Marianne can make that speech, I got to be in Toledo. Happens all the time. And when you get trapped and must speak, fearful, never trained, right? Barriers one and two. You don't like it. You're less than yourself. And so you don't do it well. And the next time, you really are going to go to Toledo, right? Fear. Number two, barrier three, the computer. Computers are wonderful. Everybody knows that. If you can work them, I can't. Nielsen just does a survey. High school kids, and they started with high school kids. They're going to look higher, older people. The average high school student, according to Nielsen, a big survey, sends or receives 3,300 text messages a month. We don't talk as much anymore. The computer and its progeny are taking us close to a world in which half of our waking hours are spent on machines. How in the world are we supposed to become comfortable speakers? One of the ways we do it is talking to each other and gesturing and eye contact and picking up words that other people know that we didn't, right? That is a big part of getting comfortable. Well, not if you're not talking half the time. This is deadly serious stuff. Barrier and last barrier four. You're not going to get much help out there on the street. You're going to learn more bad habits really than good for the most part. You're going to hear a lot of addiction to the filler words and like you know. Addiction, right? A lot of reliance for key passages, words of the bedroom and the bathroom and swear words to mask inarticulateness. You all know it's true. It's out there. And it runs not just in the street. It runs all the way up to people even seeking the highest office in our land. There's not great rhetoric going on out there. Let me just show you a few and let you pass your own judgment. Is this great stuff we've been listening to the last couple months? Let's look at it.
This feels good, being back in Michigan. You know, the trees are the right height. The streets are just right. I like the fact that most of the cars I see are Detroit-made automobiles. I drive a Mustang and a Chevy pickup truck. Ann drives a couple of Cadillacs, actually.
Smart, you think? Let's look at the next one. Just a few. You've all seen.
Absolutely. To say that people of faith have no role in the public square, you bet that makes you throw up. What kind of country do we live in that says only people of non-faith can come in the public square and make their case? That makes me throw up.
That's Santorum, a Catholic, attacking the first Catholic president, John Kennedy, whose speech about faith is the reason he became our president and barely won. Santorum himself is a Catholic, saying he wants to throw up over John Kennedy's best speech.
So you agreed with President Obama on Libya or not?
Okay, Libya.
This is after we've succeeded in Libya.
President Obama supported the uprising, correct? President Obama called for the removal of Gaddafi. Just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing before I say, yes, I agreed. I know I didn't agree. I do not agree with the way he handled it for the following reason. That's a different one. I got to go back and see.
That goes on for four more minutes. I can't stand it. You got the point. All right. Enough said. Okay. Another one.
We know there was slavery that was still tolerated when the nation began. We know that was an evil, and it was a scourge and a blot and a stain upon our history. But we also know that the very founders that wrote those documents worked tirelessly until slavery was no more in the United States. And I think it is high time that we recognize the contribution of our forebears who worked tirelessly, men like John Quincy Adams, who would not rest until slavery was extinguished in the country.
First, John Quincy Adams was not a founder. He was a founding baby. Second, had she not been to Mount Vernon, had she not been to Monticello to see the slaves' quarters, what about that war in 1860? It was in the Constitution slavery was. Okay. And last.
No,
what It comes down to, from this piece of what we have to say, is there really is a widespread national impediment in this field of being an effective, at least, and a comfortable public speaker. So that's our case. That's the reason we call it Tongue-Tied America.
So how do you go about doing this well? Our book has lots of thoughts about this, but we thought for purposes of today's talk, we'd give you a three-pronged attack that you could follow to improve your skills of verbal persuasion. So the first thing you want to do is think about your delivery, to pay attention to your presentation skills. And then your second mode of attack is you want to heed the teachings of classical rhetoric. And then plan of attack number three, you want to take a look at your writing and make sure that you are writing a presentation that is going to work for an audience when they're just listening to it, when they don't have your text in front of them. So we're going to talk about all three of those things, and I'm going to talk first about the delivery aspect of this. So I thought I would talk to you about this by playing another video clip, and I don't want you to think that we're only going after Republicans here. So I thought I would throw a Democrat under the bus. So here is what I want to show you. This is a speech that was given on February the 10th, 2009. So this means we are in the midst of our own Great Recession. And the speaker here is Timothy Geithner, who's our Treasury Secretary. So everybody's feeling very nervous about what's going to happen in this country. And the day before, President Obama says, you're going to hear a great speech. Timothy Geithner is going to tell you about our plan, this financial stability plan, and it's going to solve everything. And people want to hear that. People want to feel like there is leadership in Washington that's going to help calm the markets down and that we're going to be recovering. So all ears are open to Timothy Geithner. Here's a little clip of what he did.
This program will be built on the Federal Reserve's term asset-backed securities loan facility that was announced last November with capital from the Treasury and financing from the Federal Reserve. We've agreed to expand this program to target the markets that are critical for small business lending, for student loans, for consumer and auto finance, and for commercial mortgages. Now, in addition, because small businesses are so important to our economy, we're going to take some additional steps to make it easier for them to get credit from community banks and from large banks. By increasing the federally guaranteed portion of Small Business Association Administration loans, and by giving more power to the SBA to expedite loan approvals, we believe we can turn around the dramatic decline in SBA lending we've seen in recent months.
So what do you think? You feel better? So what's happening here? This is somebody who's not super comfortable with public speaking. In fact, he appears to be reading from a teleprompter. So you see his eyes going back and forth as he's looking at his script. It's not just his eyes. In fact, his whole body starts to sway as he's looking around the room at the different teleprompters that are set up across the space. In our culture, eye contact and body language signify something. We think that you're telling the truth if you're able to look us in the eye, if you can meet our gaze. Shifty eyes make an audience think you're hiding something. They make you think that either the person is not telling the truth or they're just feeling uncomfortable in some way about the message. Same with the body language. When you are advocating a position, you want everything you do to be part of that advocacy. It's not just the words that you're saying. It's also your physicality. And so if you are doing things that are taking away from your message, you are moving in a distracting way, some way that makes you look nervous or fidgety, then that's not the best advocacy that you could be performing. So that's what's going on there. Another problem with this presentation, there's no oomph to it. There's no power. How could there be when you are that closely wedded to your script? He's reading everything. One of the first things we try to teach our students in the classes that we teach at the law school at UVA is we try to get them to put those scripts down and actually talk to the audience. We tell them things like, a speech is not a read essay. You got to do something more. So if you're simply reading, there's very little room for drama there. It's going to affect a lot of stuff. Like, for example, it affected his voice. He was using only a few notes when he was speaking. It was really all kind of one tone, one note. It was also affecting his rhythms. You could tell that this guy is reading. It sounds like he's reciting. What you really want to go for to be effective is you want the natural rhythms of everyday human conversation, because it makes you seem more comfortable, and it's also a lot easier for your audience to understand the words coming out of your mouth. So those are the things that he should have been paying attention to. So what's the result? The New York Times reported the initial assessment of the plan from the markets was brutally negative. The stock market dipped almost as soon as Mr. Geithner began speaking in the morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 382 points by the time the market closed. So that's not the result that you're looking for. Now, you can imagine this same speech delivered by somebody like President Obama, who's a very gifted speaker, and you might have a very, very different reception, a very different result.
It's sad that this is such a struggle for so many of us, because thousands of years ago, the golden age of rhetoric and those rhetoricians told us almost everything we need to know to be persuasive. Aristotle, Cicero, Thucydides, Antiphon, Quintilian, Demosthenes. The essence of what they taught, and we don't pay enough attention to it, was ethos, pathos, logos. That is the guts of classic rhetoric. Nobody's ever improved upon it. You follow those three paths, you will be a persuasive speaker. Ethos. Ethos is connecting with your audience. It's connecting as a human being with other human beings. It's trust me. I will not lead you down the garden path. I will not overstate or misstate. I am fair. And in a perfect world, I even hope you like me. That's ethos. It's up there as number one because it is number one. If any speaker wins the ethos question before an audience, is believed to be liked, is believed to be likable, and is respected and is trusted, that person is halfway home to persuasion. Not 100, half. But if a person loses the ethos test, there is no recovery. If you form a judgment that you don't like this person, doesn't know his or her stuff, is cocky, arrogant, sarcastic, cheating, fast and loose, the ethos battle is lost and you will never recover. There is no etch-a-sketch button you can push if you have lost the ethos battle. You don't get to shake it. Mulligan, going to do it all over again. Absolutely no. No one, in my experience, I tried a lot of cases, has ever lost the ethos battle and won the case. It cannot be done. And in Romney's case, he's got a problem with connecting. He doesn't want people out there saying, shake up my old etch-a-sketch. We'll just reset. We'll try all over again. No, he's lost a big battle already. He may win the presidency. I don't know. It won't be because he won the ethos battle. That's for darn sure. Pathos. We are human beings, and we ought to be able to connect with each other from time to time by attracting our emotions attracting each other. Yeah, that's a good thing. There are times for it, aren't there? For sure, when you need to show genuine emotion. But listen to that word, genuine. It has to be perceived as genuine. Misuse of pathos, over-reliance on pathos or emotion, it backfires. If you use it too much, or if it's perceived to be cheap shot stuff, I don't really think that speaker believes that. There goes ethos. The issue I said you had to prevail on is gone. I think the person's a cheater with too much pathos. Or what if an audience decides you're just out of control emotionally? You are so emotional about a topic that you've lost it. I already see a smile right there. You know what I'm going to play now, and I am.
You know something? Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
There went another Democratic candidate's presidential aspirations that night. Pathos problem. Aristotle would have turned over in his grave. So did two rhetoric teachers at the University of Virginia, I will tell you for sure. Santorum. It's a pathos issue that we look at. Always angry. Fire in his eyes. JFK makes a very important speech, and he says he wants to throw up. The president is a bum, a snob, for aspirationally wanting people to get more education in high school, which is all he ever said, technical schools or anything else. He's a big snob, the president. And he wants to throw up over another president, John Kennedy. That's in the pathos country of, are you sure that you trust all that anger, all that fire and brimstone, and the savageness of those attacks? That's a pathos problem. Newt wants to put a colony on the moon, and he also says we ought to have a world in which Congress can hail judges before them, subpoena them if they don't like the opinions, can overrule that. He said all this, can overrule their opinions, and fire them. The 9% approval Congress should be able to be the judicial court of last resort. He said it. Well, you kind of said, what's going on in that mind? Rhetoric teachers want to know about that. We come to logos. We are, as human beings, very attracted to logic. We understand it has to be clear, and this is true all the way, from the cab driver to the person he's driving in the cab. We are born to be interested in inconsistencies, in contradictions, or things that do follow as night from day, but simple, clear logic. That's why Aristotle, one of the brightest people that ever lived, came up with the syllogism. Major premise, minor premise, conclusion. We can get that, and everybody can get that, and you ought to see juries, they go silent when you can make a point that this testimony was completely inconsistent with this. Did you hear it? People will listen to logos, clear, if it's done. The troubles here are for a lot of these people. Perry doing the whoops moment. Others, Michelle, we just saw. Gee, they stamped out slavery. Those great founding fathers did. Lots of problems there. A perfect course in Rhetoric 101 comes now and last on this piece from another failed presidential candidacy. This is Rhetoric 101. Listen, and I'll try to explain why we think this is our whole course in one speech.
There it is. Would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
He's been asked.
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think murdered. You know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why we have had the biggest drop in crime of any industrial state in America, why we have the lowest murder rate of any industrial state in America. But we have work to do in this nation. We have work to do to fight a real war, not a phony war against drugs, and that's something that I want to lead, something we haven't had over the course of the past many years, even though the vice president has been at least allegedly in charge of that war. We have much to do to step up that war, to double the number of drug enforcement agents, to fight both here and abroad, to work with our neighbors in this hemisphere. And I want to call a hemispheric summit just as soon after the 20th of January as possible to fight that war. But we also have to deal with drug education and prevention here at home.
His candidacy was dogged by 2 points. He was ahead in the polls when this happened, second debate. One, it was perceived by a lot of people that he simply didn't have a heart. Smart guy, likable enough, told the truth. No heart, no oomph, no yeah. Problem one. Problem two, he was unalterably opposed to the death penalty in all cases and said so. But polls showed 2/3 of those polled wouldn't go that far. Many didn't like the death penalty much, but they didn't like the never ever. So Bernie Shaw fed him that question. Your wife of 35 years has just been raped and murdered, recognizing, of course, it's a hypothetical question. Now what do you say about the death penalty? And he said, well, it didn't work very well in Massachusetts. He was supposed to give a 3-minute answer. That was the rule in that debate. He went for 6 minutes, 5 of which he's talking about drugs coming in from South America. I mean, when you heard the answer, you kind of wanted to say, do you remember the question? What if he had said American history would have changed, I believe, dramatically, if Bush Sr., whom he was running against, lost? It probably follows that Bush Jr., who owned a baseball team in Texas then, is maybe not going to become president for 8 years. Important moment. Rhetoric matters. What if he says, I am against the death penalty in all cases? I'd want to rip that son of a gun from stem to stern. And you know I would. I've been in love with her for 35 years. Here's why. In South Dakota, you get the death penalty a mile across state line. In North Dakota, you do not. 11 international treaties have been torpedoed because other countries didn't agree with us on the death penalty. 17 major studies have been produced demonstrating there is an inherent racial bias in the death penalty. We're up to 280 people who have been convicted in court, many of them capital cases. Well, DNA now proves they didn't do it. But the most important point is the job of government in the Constitution and every state constitution is to promote life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. My view is government has more exalted tasks to do than to lob cyanide pills into jail cells. You ask for my position, that's it. I recognize people of goodwill may feel a different way. That's my position. I think you've changed American history. And I beat 3 minutes. He didn't do it, though. And that leads me back to another disappointing sentence. This good stuff is out there that tells us how to do it and how not to do it. But it's gathering dust in college libraries all over the land. That's too darn bad.
Do you want to grade him?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is painful, but all right. I will. How would you grade the guy? Look, there's no way. Ethos. Can you like the guy better than before he gave the answer? He doesn't even mention her name. He doesn't. He just talks about drugs coming in. Pathos. Again, he doesn't mention his wife's name. Does he care? Does he even care about the death penalty? A guy was trying to set him up to show some oomph, darn it. And he talks about drugs. What happened? You think he was tired from campaigning and his handler said at some point, talk about drugs. And he gets that question and says, this is a terrific time to play the old drug card. My wife's just been murdered. It's just preposterous. But it happened and there went a president, a serious presidential candidate. Logos? What logos? Didn't make a single point of the 5 that I just made and could be made in 2 minutes. Not a single one. Nobody could turn off the TV and say to their spouse, I really don't agree with that guy, but doggone it, he has some points, and he seems to believe them, and I like him fine. I just don't agree with him, and I'll probably vote against him. Could that have happened? No.
So you also want to pay attention to your writing when you are putting together a verbal presentation. And what you want to think about is what the audience is expecting. You want to think about what they already know, what they're hoping to get from the presentation, and you want to design it so that you can connect with them. You also want to think about the fact that your audience is getting this information through their ears. They don't have a copy of your script. And so that means you have to make it simple and clean, something that people can follow just by listening to you. So that was another problem that Timothy Geithner was having in the video that I showed you of him. He had this script that was so difficult to perform because the sentences were extremely long. There's no place to take a breath. If you do that, it's going to be much, much harder for your audience to process them. He's full of jargon, full of tongue twisters. This plan revolves around, let's see, the Federal Reserve's term asset-backed securities loan facility. I can't even say that very easily. And then he talks about federally guaranteed loans, which come out federally guaranteed in his recitation. That's a tongue twister. And so what you want to do is practice your presentation and find those tongue twisters and figure out a different way to say them. Now, very often in many situations, rather than writing out a full script, you're going to want bullet points. And you're going to stand up, you're going to talk about each one, you're going to make sure that they follow follow logically, and that's going to help you connect with your audience better. But there are situations in which you will want to write a full script. If you are doing the State of the Union address, you are delivering a eulogy, you are making a wedding toast, those are more formal occasions, and for that, you might really want to craft every word. So I'd like to give you an example of somebody who came up with a terrific little speech, and it is a good model for what you want to do when you're writing. We actually have a bunch of these. We had a really good time in the last part of Tongue Tied America choosing our 12 favorite speeches and then analyzing what we like about them, why they work. So this is one of our 12. So the speaker here is not a professional orator. He's a baseball player. It's this guy, Lou Gehrig. But on July the 4th, 1939, he stood up and he made a speech that moved the nation to tears. So here's what was going on. Look at how young this man is. He is 36 years old. And he discovered on his 36th birthday that he was suffering from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is ALS. We now call it Lou Gehrig's disease. It is a frightening, debilitating condition. First you have trouble swallowing, and then you have trouble speaking. Eventually, your whole body shuts down. You're going to be paralyzed, but your mind remains keen and aware to the end. So that's what he's facing. Obviously, he's not going to be able to play baseball anymore. So his teammates, his fans, the people who love him, they want to do something to celebrate him. So they decide they're going to have a big party. They call it Lou Gehrig Day. They have a big celebration at Yankee Stadium, and everybody comes, thousands of people. And they present him with flowers and trophies. And at the end of everything, he stands up, and he makes this wonderful speech. So here's his speech. It starts like this. Fans, for the past 2 weeks, you have been reading about a bad break I got. Yet today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of this earth. All right, that's his first paragraph. Your first paragraph of your verbal presentation is extremely important. Psychologists call this the moment of primacy. It is the moment when you are making your first impression on the audience, and they're deciding whether or not they want to give you their full attention. It is also the moment that's most likely to stick with them. So their attention's fresh, they're listening, so you want to jump right in with something that is going to hook them, make them interested, and you want it to be the thing that you want them to remember. So very often that means you need a theme. You need some sort of good theme that you're going to follow throughout the speech. So he's got one. His theme is that he is the luckiest man on the face of this earth. Okay, that's a fantastic theme. There is ethos there and pathos as well. There is something so likable and fine about somebody who could look at this terrible, terrible prognosis and declare himself a lucky man and call it a bad break. So right away, you want to know, how is it that this man is lucky? And you want to hear what he has to say. That bad break thing is also really great writing for speaking. First, it's alliterative, bad break, so it catches the ear. You want to look for those figures of speech that are really figures of sound that make your ears kind of perk up when people use them. So bad break works that way, and it also works because it is conversational. You feel like this is probably how this man actually talks. So there's an authenticity there, a genuineness. When you are coming up with your own style, you want to start with the four corners of who you are, because that is the person that is most likely to be able to connect with the audience. All right, so that's his beginning. So he goes on into the middle, and here he's going to develop his theme of being the luckiest man. So here's the first part of the middle of his speech. I have been in ballparks for 17 years and have never received anything but kindness and encouragement from you fans. Look at these grand men. Which of you wouldn't consider it the highlight of his career just to associate with them for even one day? Sure, I'm lucky. So he's developing this theme through repetition. The lucky thing, it's coming back again. Repetition, extremely useful when you are writing for speaking, because we will notice it and we will remember it. He's also got this great sentence construction. Look at these grand men. Sure, I'm lucky. Those are two short sentences. Short, pithy sentences pop when you are speaking to an audience. So contrast that with Timothy Geithner and his Federal Reserve's Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility. You want to go with the shorter sentences, especially if you have this great rhythm that he's got going here, which is he's got longer conversational sentences in which he's describing a scene, and then he punctuates them with a short, pithy statement. and then look at these grand men and the fact that he's talking about the fans. That's a great way of establishing pathos. That's a connection with the audience. You know, this man, this is Lou Gehrig Day. He could have come in there and talked about Lou Gehrig. He could have talked about his triumphs on the ball field. But he's outward looking. He's thinking about the audience. And what he's doing in this speech is saying thank you. That's going to be moving. That's going to be something that people want to hear. So here's continuing on with the middle. He's going to continue to develop this theme, but listen to the rhythms of how he does it. When the New York Giants, a team you would give your right arm to beat and vice versa, send you a gift, that's something. When everybody down to the groundskeepers and those boys in white coats remember you with trophies, that's something. When you have a wonderful mother-in-law who takes sides with you and squabbles with her own daughter, that's something. When you have a father and a mother who work all their lives so you can have an education and build your body, it's a blessing. When you have a wife who has been a tower of strength and shown more courage than you dreamed existed, that's the finest I know. That's something, that's something, that's something that catches the ear. It is a triple. If you are looking for some snazzy way to get your audience's attention, I highly recommend a triple. There's something about the pattern of three in this culture. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. We like things in threes, so that's a great way to put it into your speech and make it catchy. And then he's got the lovely ethos moment where he is saying thank you to his mother-in-law, which sort of turns all the mother-in-law jokes on their heads. And then he builds to the father and the mother, and then finally the wife, stacking the thank yous that way. That's pathos right there. That's very, very moving. The other thing that he's doing is he's using sensory language. So sensory language is language that appeals to the senses. He's describing the boys in the white coats and the flowers. He's painting a picture that you can imagine. And if you can do that, if you can get your audience to visualize what you are talking about, it's going to stick with them a lot longer. His conclusion, his last paragraph. So I close in saying that I may have had a tough break, but I have an awful lot to live for. So you want a conclusion. So many of our students want to just run off the stage. They want to say, that's all I have to say about that, and then they want to sit down. You got to have sort of, you know, the punctuation at the end of the speech. We got to feel like there's a nice wrap at the end. And you want it very often to echo the theme that you started with the beginning. But you don't want to just repeat what was in that first paragraph. You want to do something more with it. So a way to think of it is theme plus. Theme plus an action item. What is it that you want your audience to remember and do once the speech is over? So that's what he's doing here. He's saying, it's not over yet. Stay tuned. So I couldn't find a video of Lou Gehrig doing this whole speech, but I did find a little snippet, and I thought I would play that for you so you get a flavor of what he was like as a speaker.
At first, Gehrig was too moved to speak.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad brag. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
That's a hard speech to follow, but it sets the theme for the end of what we want to say. We want to end on an up note. You may not have thought that was an up moment, but it was a brilliant, magnificent speech from a non-speaker. He could do it because he could relate to people. Here's our upbeat message. We've said some negative things so far. I hope everything we've said is true. Over the last 10 years, we've taught about 100 classes and nearly 2,000 students. Three messages have come through loud and clear. Number one, vast improvement as a speaker is achievable. It has been achievable for everyone. Second, it comes rapidly. This is not rocket science. It's not learning a new foreign language. Our classes are only 13 weeks long, 2.5 hours once a week. By closing argument, week 13, they are terrific. Everybody is good. Some are wow. I have given 2 critiques last year, and all I could say was wow. That was it. They just blew us both away. They get that good in 13 weeks. Able people. They've done the hard work. They got all the ability. All you got to do is help them get there. And nobody ever did before. And the third message is, as everybody gets more comfortable, a little better with gestures, with body movement, with eye contact, with weaning themselves from notes, as they get better, nobody ever in this world regresses. You never go backwards the rest of your life. You're always at least at this level and just getting better. There's no backfalling in the world of becoming a distinguished speaker. A wonderful example, and we have a couple of examples now and we'll end. A couple of examples is Al Gore. Can you get better? Yeah, he was a middle-aged guy. The knock on Al Gore, again, was that he was a zombie, that he was stiff. Very bright guy, been in government his whole life, father had been a senator. There was a time he was slightly ahead in the polls. His hand, he was always stiff and red an awful lot from the podium, with one exception, and I'm going to show you the exception just because it's funny. His handlers told him he had to do something to liven it up during the second debate. This, for the first time in American history, happened during a debate. I think it will never happen again.
That's what the question in this campaign is about. It's not only what's your philosophy and what's your position on issues, but can you get things done? And I believe I can.
All right.
What about the Dingell Norwood bill?
It never happened before. He literally left his dais. They're over in the two planned spots where every candidate has always stood, probably since Abe Lincoln and Douglas, for all I know. He leaves and goes the look on Bush's face is hysterical. What is this guy? Is he going to hit me? What's he going to do? But that was his idea of hamming it up, and it's kind of the only time he came from out from under the burden of his notes was that funny attack, which did not go over well. He was not a good speaker then, and he barely lost, but he lost in part because he was not a good advocate, and had he even been a good advocate, he would have probably had a pretty good chance to win. Contrast that with a few years later, he took his speaking very seriously, was worried about that fact that he had not been perceived a good speaker, and he got some very able people to help him, and lo and behold, out comes a Nobel Prize winning film. Just look at a little bit of it.
The scientific consensus is that we are causing global warming. I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America. This is Patagonia, 75 years ago, and the same glacier today. This is Mount Kilimanjaro, 30 years ago, and last year. Within the decade, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro.
This is really not a political issue so much as a moral issue.
Again, he didn't change his persona. He didn't go back to school and learn a bunch of stuff that he didn't know before. He became a good advocate. He was comfortable. He was relaxed. He was walking when it made sense in cadence with what he was saying. He had really learned to use all the demonstrative power of PowerPoint in 100 different ways, and we just showed you a few seconds of it, but he really used it. No notes. He cheated off of his PowerPoint. That's one of the secrets about getting away from notes. Yeah, totally comfortable the whole time. And to me, one of the most remarkable moments there is not only the powerful use of PowerPoint, and we get to see glaciers falling into the ocean at the end if I showed you more. It is the ability of the great advocate to be able to tie points in a bow. And when he showed us Kilimanjaro and those glaciers, that's one thing. It's very hard to walk out of this room and forget about Kilimanjaro. But how about when he paused and said, within the decade, there will be no more snows at Kilimanjaro. Try to get that sentence out of your head. That's a great advocate. He tied all of that into a bow. Now he's an advocate, but he's no longer running for president of the United States. We got a couple of others that we want to end with.
I'll echo what Bob said and say that becoming proficient at this is absolutely achievable for everybody, and it is one of the most empowering things that you can do for yourself. It is professionally empowering to be able to articulate your ideas aloud, because it's the sort of thing that is going to get you the job. It's going to help you in a job interview. Once you've landed the job, you're going to be able to attract clients, connect with colleagues, impress your boss. All those things are good. But on top of it, it is also personally extremely empowering. If you feel confident that you can take this idea that is in your head and say it to another person in a way that that person will understand and respond to, you will be so much more likely to speak up. The more you're speaking up, the better you're going to get at it, and the better you're going to feel about it. The more you do it, the more fun you're going to have. You're going to find out it is tremendously fun to talk to people. So we want to show two last clips to sort of make that point. They are from very, very different contexts, but they are both situations in which the speaker was able to accomplish great things because of his or her confidence in her in verbal presentation abilities. So the first speaker is one of my favorites. This is Barbara Jordan, who was a freshman congresswoman back during the Nixon impeachment hearings. She's a woman who has a great deal of power when she speaks. And what I want to show you here is a clip of her keynote address at the 1976 Democratic National Convention. And I would say the two things that characterize Barbara Jordan are power and a great deal of joy. So listen to her.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for a very warm reception. It was 144 years ago that members of the Democratic Party first met in convention to select a presidential candidate. Since that time, Democrats have continued to convene once every 4 years and draft a party platform and nominate a presidential candidate. And our meeting this week is a continuation of that tradition. But there is something different about tonight. There is something special about tonight. What is different? What is special? I, Barbara Jordan, am a keynote speaker.
Completely different setting. It's April 4, 1968. Martin Luther King has just been killed. Robert Kennedy's on his way to a rally in Indianapolis. His phone rings and he finds out about the assassination. The crowd has already gathered. No one knows it. Robert Kennedy does. He talks to his staff and his Secret Service people and the local police as soon as he gets to the appointed spot, and they all say, you can't go in there. Buildings are being burned down all over the country right now. You're going to have a riot. We can't protect you. Bobby Kennedy had written some notes, honestly, on an envelope on the way, and he said, I have to. I'll go. This is what happened.
Those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country and greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand, compassion, and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times.
Hard to know what to say after that as well. That little piece of paper in his hand was the envelope on which he'd written the notes. You notice he didn't look. There comes a time that it pays off to be great. He needed it that night. So our message is pretty simple. It is that everybody needs to be and can be an effective oral communicator. That the task of achieving improvement, maybe ultimately aspirationally greatness, is more exhilarating than pain, and that the payoff is rich. And thank you for coming.
Just what I had hoped for, what I remember. I wish you had played a little farther as you had for the radio program. Bobby Kennedy referring to his favorite poet.
Aeschylus.
Yes. We worried
about time.
I had never heard this story, and to think that this man had composed this in the limo against better judgment and the counsel that he should not speak about it at all, just phenomenal. Let's take questions now. What do we have for about 10 minutes? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Two questions, if I may.
I should have asked you to wait. Let's all wait for the microphone to come, and then we'll be able to hear it broadly.
Two questions, if I may, requiring only short answers, at least in the first one. Do you have any idea how many colleges now teach public speaking and require it? And secondly, are there any members of Congress that stand out as particularly effective speakers in your mind?
I know a little bit about the first. You can do the second.
Yeah, I'm going to leave the second to you, Bob.
I have gotten a survey of that from the head of the department at Stanford that does this. Thankfully, more and more have courses, and we're up to something like at least 20, some of whom have very good courses. Almost none of them require it. And so I was talking to somebody yesterday from a major college on the East Coast who had one of our students now who had a great course at Rutgers, and explained they videotape, they do everything we do of all the speeches, and she's pretty great herself. And I was so impressed, and then I said, how many people were in your class? 20. How many in other classes? None. Only 20 people elected to take it. So we may be up to, I know of at least five universities that require, and I'm proud my undergraduate school does, that require freshmen to take a course that's videotaped, the whole shoot and match that we do. And a number of the smaller, Hamilton, a number of the smaller schools are really good on this stuff. Whether Hamilton requires it or not, it's kind of famous for being great at it. I don't remember if they require it. The problem is, it's great that it's starting to break. People are beginning to teach it more and more and more. I wish it were required. It seems to me this is just part of becoming an effective human being when you leave college.
Yeah, it's interesting that in law schools, you would think that this would be a home for this sort of training, and that's where we teach, but it's actually really unusual for a law school to have this sort of course. And so there's a big discussion right now. There was a report that came out from the Carnegie Foundation, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, that analyzed the state of legal education and said that lawyers are not being trained to actually be sort of practice ready. They're being trained on a very abstract level, and they'd like to see more classes like what you just sort of saw a snippet of from us, but it is extremely unusual at most schools, and you know, we have theories about why. A big problem with it is it's expensive to teach this sort of thing. It requires small classes. You got to let your students stand up and talk every week, and so that means you're going to have to pay faculty. You're going to have a lot of faculty, and it's more cost effective for universities to have one professor with 100 students in the room. So that could explain it. As for who's effective in Congress, I'm punting that one to Bob.
I wish I'd had the question of Anson. I'd have made a list. I think on the right, for instance, that Ryan says what he means to say, and clearly. I'm always impressed by Senator Kerry, I think, for instance. Barbara Boxer gets it out. She's, for my taste, a little too strong sometimes, but I think she's quite articulate. And beyond that, I have to go make a list. I would have one by tonight. But there are some effective public speakers in Congress. The problem comes in when we go too wild on the pathos side and just take positions that you don't need to take to get from here to there. You could go partway and begin to grab the middle. And I think trying to attract, be sensible, and no bridges too far is more effective advocacy in general than what we're seeing, which is overstating the president's a horrible person and JFK, I want to throw up. That kind of stuff is just anathema to a rhetoric teacher. I don't think it's persuasive for most people most of the time.
I'll follow the precedent and ask two questions. My first question is, do you think that Geithner was perhaps hindered by having someone else having written that speech, and that he was simply delivering someone else's clueless words? And the flip side of that question is, do you have any idea whether Lou Gehrig had prepared what he said, or was he ad-libbing? But the other question is, do you think Toastmasters is a useful program, a useful retail program in the community for acquiring some of these skills that you've been talking about?
I think Toastmasters is a great idea. I think anything that's going to let you stand up and practice again and again is going to make you better. So Toastmasters is a great, great way to do it. Geithner, I don't know whether he wrote that speech himself or not, but I do think that he's better, you know, when you see him on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer or something and he's just answering questions, he's better than he was delivering that speech. So that may be part of it. And I think that a great rule of thumb for being effective is making sure that you write your own material, because it needs to be something that resonates with you, something that you know really well. Gehrig, I don't know for sure whether he wrote in advance, but I would be astonished if he didn't. I think it would be very difficult to come up with something as well-crafted as that on the fly.
I was going to ask if you thought that with sort of the advent of basically the crazy pathos spewing of cable television, that maybe audiences are kind of being driven towards thinking and being honestly programmed to see bad speakers as good speakers. That, you know, they see those people at such an extreme that when somebody isn't that extreme, they go, well, this person must not really feel it.
I think it's exactly right that because of the extremes now being run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that it's people are beginning to conclude that it's okay to go almost all that way. If people are way out here, it must be okay to be anywhere in between. I think it is having an influence toward pushing to more extreme rhetoric. It's hard to imagine we could get any worse than we are right this minute. But yes, I would think the extreme views taken, and on the radio, just as much as on cable TV, have had an effect on moving us to more bridge too far, overstated, angry rhetoric. Just turn the radio on and you'll hear it. And then your point is people out on the street are maybe coming close to echoing that, and I think that's right.
I think that there's always been extreme rhetoric, but I think what is different now is that it's very easy to stay in your own little echo chamber and only hear people who agree with you and sort of get yourself fired up by what they're saying and then think that that is going to be persuasive to everybody. And I think the problem with extreme rhetoric is it's not going to be persuasive to people who don't already agree with you. And so ultimately, you know, over time, I don't think it's going to be successful, but I agree that it probably becomes the model that people think they have to follow. Yeah. And what we're trying to teach in our classes is that that's not going to get you what you want.
Rhetoric used to be taught in the high schools. And would you go try to advocate that again? Because I think that's where it ought to begin.
My view is it would be wonderful to be teaching rhetoric, which is sometimes just a college course now, but any teaching at any level. My wife, who's sitting back there, says kid who taught kindergarten and whatnot, kids at five love to talk. They're not afraid. And then we kind of turn it off. In grade school, fine. High school, oh, yeah. The more, the doggone merrier, if our thesis is right, that this is not more important than being a great writer or a thinker or having good judgment. But it's right up there with all those guys. And we ought to be teaching, in my opinion, having experience in it, seminars, talking in class, should be absolutely part and parcel of the American education experience, and it is not. And we're mad about it.
And there's a chapter about it in Tongue Tied America, so you could take a look at the book.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you again.
From the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.